Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
Those who commit murders always tell someone, and I don't think they ever get over it. The three people who have been acquitted in trials that I've had, one of them committed suicide, one's a drug addict, and one's someone who reached out to me and he says, I can't live with myself. So even if they beat it and they walk away, I think it totally destroys them.
That's the voice of Ron Idles, career copper, and the subject of Justine Ford's excellent book, The Good Cop. Ron worked homicide in Melbourne for over 30 years and he had a clearance rate of 99%, earning him a nickname he really hates, Australia's Greatest Detective. Ron's just not that kind of guy, you know, and it's his humility and his preparedness to be honest about the emotional toll of the job that set him apart over the years, in good and in bad ways. Ron's a bit of a crier, which is not what we expect from hard men, is it? But it's probably why so many of them break. Ron hasn't broken. He's retired to far north Queensland with his beautiful wife. But he won't be changing his mobile number, just in case. I'll let him tell you why. And later on in this episode, we'll have another book recommendation from Emily Webb, our very own crime writer. Unfortunately, Emily was unavailable when it came to chatting with beautiful Ron, so it's just me for this first bit, and then Emily and I will be back with a book recommendation at the end of the episode. This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out what makes people killers, what makes people victims, and what happens next. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Australia's greatest detective, Ron Idles. Of all the cases that you've worked on, some of the biggest in, well, certainly the biggest in living memory in Melbourne, which are the ones that stick with you for whatever reason?
I think obviously the last one that I worked on.
Which one was that?
Was the murder of Michelle Buckingham. She was a 16-year-old girl that was murdered at Shepparton in 1982. Stabbed 19 times and her body was left on the side of the road. Late 2013, a young journalist at Shepparton News came and saw me, Tammy Mills, and she said, no one cares about this 16-year-old girl. I want to write a story about it. Mm. And I said, well, I don't have enough staff to actually do it. And she said, well, I want to write the story. Eventually, I went to Shepparton and I met her and I said, all right, you write the story. We'll see what information comes in. And then a man rang up and I went and met him one night on the middle of the Shepparton East Football Oval. I went on my own and he turned up. He said, I'll tell you who killed her. It's my brother-in-law.
Oh, wow.
And then he went into the details and I knew right then and there it was true because the body wasn't found for 10 days and when the brother-in-law told him was the day after she went missing.
Oh, wow.
So when he gets told, the body hadn't been found. So then I had to go and tell the mother, Michelle's mum, and I remember my heart was pounding and I was walking up the driveway, it's about 10 o'clock at night, and I knocked on the door and she came out. She's a big German lady. She said, who are you? And I told her. She said, come in. I said, I think I can solve your daughter's murder. She said, well, the last detective told me that, but it didn't happen. And she said, whilst I know that she's buried and we had a funeral, I waited for 20 years for her to come home every day. And then my doctor told me to get over it and move on. And now 30 years on, you're standing here telling me that you can solve it. You've made the emotion as raw as it was day one. And why should I trust her? I said, well, it's up to you. She gave me a big hug and she said, I'll trust you. So for the next 18 months, I worked on it. I identified the person responsible, Stephen Bradley, who was living up in Queensland. And ultimately, after three or four different interviews, he was charged. And then the trial was September last year, and a week before the trial, Elvira, the mum, had a massive heart attack and never saw the final result.
No.
So when you make a commitment to somebody and the fact that it was 28, 30 years on, that's one that will stay with me probably for a long time.
I know that the families of victims will phone you, unsolved murders, will phone you for years. I believe Mark James still phones you.
I had a conversation with Mark James Friday last week, so we're talking 37 years on.
After his mum was murdered.
After his mum was murdered, and he rang to have a conversation, just really to say hello, how things, I'll miss you when you're gone, but he'll still have the phone number and, you know, there's no doubt we'll still have contact once I retire.
But how is that pressure on you to have family members phoning you in the middle of your day, you're working on God knows what, how many cases at once, and you're yanked back into that situation where you're someone's only hope?
I think that's right. I think people use you, or if you've been involved in that case, you're their only hope. You're the one who is going to solve it. So if we go back to December 1994, Elizabeth Memory went missing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't investigate that initially, but I took it over 6, 7 years later. Then for the next 13 years, every Tuesday morning, Roger or Joy would ring me. What are you doing about my daughter's death? When do you think you're going to solve it? And I'd say, well, I'm sorry, but I've got 4 or 5 other new investigations and we'll get around to it. 10 years on, and I said to them, look, I've eliminated everybody that's in this file and there's nothing more we can do. Well, that's not good enough. So then they got the Herald Sun to write an article. Basically, police have hit the wall. Someone came forward and said, you should have looked at this person from day one. And then when I went back in the file, the person's name was there and he's the person who ultimately charged. But sadly, he was acquitted. But there is enormous pressure sometimes. If you look at Jane Thurgood Dove, that's Oaks Day 1997, there was, I think, community pressure, an expectation that you were going to solve it. Here's a mother of three shot in the driveway of a home.
In suburban Melbourne, in Nidri, a place that you never hear of on the news because it's just one of those sweet, gentle, low-key, conservative suburbs. And she came home with her kids in the car, and a man chased her around her car and gunned her down in the driveway.
That's right. And she had the three children, and Scott was sitting in the front seat and he saw the gun come up and, you know, he shot his mum in the back of the head. But there's an expectation then that we need this to be solved. We need the community to be safe. So you take on board that pressure. And then, you know, 13 years down the track, you're still going. And sadly, it's a case of mistaken identity and those involved are deceased.
So from my recollection, there were people who were sent to murder a blonde lady in this street.
So,
and they got the wrong lady?
They should have gone to another house in the street, which was 3 houses from the corner. Mm. Jane lived 3 houses from the corner of Hoffman Road. They should have gone 3 houses from another corner.
Oh, my God.
They both had weatherboard houses. The driveways were on the right-hand side. They both drove a four-wheel drive vehicle. So they picked the wrong house.
That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Some crooks aren't that smart, though.
Oh, I know, I know.
But it is unbelievable, and no one deserves to die, but there is no connection. Normally, in a homicide inquiry, 98% of murders are committed by someone known to the victim. You're not going to be shot by or killed by someone you don't know, and it's always then a matter of finding that connection. And I always say, work from the family out, eliminate those, their associates, their friends, and you work your way out. In most cases, you're going in some direction in 48 hours. If you're not going somewhere in 48 hours, you normally know that you're going to be there for the long haul.
Family violence is really at the sort of at the bottom of most murders, isn't it?
Family violence, like if we went back to 1980, we had 110, 100, maybe a little bit over murders a year. Majority of those, 50 to 60%, were family violence. We now have around 60, 62 murders, and there's a less percentage of those that are family violence, but there's still a large proportion.
I've heard you say that back in the day, you realise now that family violence just wasn't taken as seriously. In fact, the armed robbery squad thought you guys in homicide were a bit soft because all you really did was mop up after domestics.
Well, they used to call us the heavy domestic squad.
Yeah.
And it changed when I think governments and communities started to look at family violence. Back in early 70s when I worked at Collingwood, we had no tools to actually deal with family violence. So Thursday night was pay night for the painters and dockers around Collingwood. They would go to the pub, get pissed, go home, and there would be a domestic dispute. The wife would ring up, we'd go around and we'd arrest the husband for being drunk outside his house. We'd ask him to come out and then we'd arrest him. Mm. 4 hours in the cells, and that's how we dealt with it. And then you'd get be back there the next week. So it is something which was never addressed properly, and now I probably see the results of that.
So today, coppers would look at that and see an escalation of violence or a pattern of violence and take it seriously as a potential homicide, do you think? Whereas that didn't happen before?
Well, no, it didn't happen before, but now if you go to a domestic dispute and someone's been assaulted, you have to take out an intervention order. Both parties have to go to court. There's a proper process to go through. If they're recidivist offenders, then they can be put into different counselling options, but there's more support and more help. But it's taken very seriously by Victoria Police, and they've got a whole family violence unit now.
Mm. For the last couple of years, you've been working, advocating for police officers.
So for the last 3 years, I've been the Secretary of the Police Association. So that rolls around speaking out on their behalf, dealing with the enterprise bargaining. We've been under-resourced for a long time, and we've just been successful in getting 2,700 extra police officers over the next few years. And one of the big issues, I think, that we face is mental illness or psychological injury. Mm. When I started to talk about this 18 months ago, 30% of the members who put in a claim for a psychological injury got their claim accepted. Through work with Victoria Police's insurer, Gallagher Bassett, WorkSafe, we now got that to about 78%, because the sooner you get treatment, the sooner you come back to work. So if you're off work for 12 months, you're not coming back. So it's about early intervention, early treatment. Initially, when I started to talk about it, some people were critical of it, but you have to talk about it. And I think as a result of talking about it, we now work well with Victoria Police, and it's about looking after our members.
Well, you've been told to rein in your own emotions, haven't you, over the years? You've had superiors who've said, Ron, come on, you can't shed a tear over a job.
I did a homicide investigation of a lady that went missing, and her husband got up and he made a very emotional plea, and there wasn't a dry eye in the room, which included me. Some 2 months after that, I was called up to say, we're worried about you. We think you're cracking up. You shouldn't be crying on TV. And I said, oh, you're worried about me? Well, why didn't you come and see me the day after rather than 2 months later? So some people have seen my emotion as a sign of I'm not coping, but I think it's the other way. It's actually how I cope.
Yeah, it's an outlet.
Yeah, like you try not to become emotionally involved in crimes, but like I go into a house and this guy shot his three children, 9, 6, and 3, and then shoots himself. Now, when you're at that scene, you need to recreate that scene to work out what's happened. Now, when you recreate it, I can see the little girl on the bed. I can see the boy in a wardrobe that's made to face the wall when he's shot in the back of the head. I don't care how tough you are, but when I got home from that, I bawled my eyes out, because it's about recreating that event. And the coroner came out and she said, Ron, I want to go in. And I said, you don't need to go in there, right? I'm telling you, you don't need to go in there. But she said, oh, I want to go in. So she went in and she came out and she got in the car and she rang me about 2 minutes later. She said, I can't even drive. I'm an emotional wreck. So it's about how you deal with it. You must have an outlet. You must talk about it. And for times, if you need it, you go and seek professional help.
Oh, you broke our hearts in that documentary, excellent documentary on the ABC about Jill Maher's death and the investigation. And I remember when you got upset when you were thinking about your interview of Jill's husband, Tom Maher, and how you'd had to go hard on him because that's your job. And the first assumption is that he is involved somehow. That's the way it usually goes.
Well, when you look at that case, he was at home and she was at the hotel.
He was at home alone. He had no one to corroborate that.
And he says, look, I was concerned about her. And I sent her some text messages. But then when you check the phone was off for 4 hours. Then you've got to ask yourself, hang on a minute, why is the phone off? And then her handbag, which wasn't there on Saturday, turns up in the laneway on the Monday. So then you say, who's got you speculate to accumulate. Oh, I know what's happened. He's had the phone off. More than likely he's got home. There's been an argument. Forgot the handbag, so I'll put the handbag back. Mm. Now, then when you actually investigate it, the butcher found the handbag. And then when all the publicity came, he thought, shit, they might think it's me, so I'll put the handbag back. And then the reality is Tom had a flat battery on his phone. And then there's video footage of him walking down Sydney Road looking for his wife at about 5 o'clock. Now, we know at 5 o'clock her phone is out near Gisborne. So that's the way that he was eliminated. But initially, yes, you're going to look at him. Yes, you're going to search his house. Yes, you're going to do all the forensics, because until you eliminate him, you probably can't go to the next step. So it's about having a list of potential suspects, and then one by one you eliminate them. But it's also about not putting all your resources into one basket, because if you do that and you only ever concentrate on him, you'll go wrong. So you set some people up, detectives, to do that, but then you have the others to deal with all the other information that comes in.
But then you, instead of walking away from that scenario and saying, oh, well, I just did my job, you actually took it very hard when you later thought about what Tom was going through in that interview room when you were doing your job. It made you very upset.
I think, at times it does. At times it gets to you and you reflect back on what you've done, and then you think, well, could you have done it a different way? The answer is probably no, but then, you know, here's somebody who's lost his wife, and then you've got to ask these questions and basically put them through the ringer. You know, if I look at Jane Thurgood Dove's husband, you know, Mark, and I've got to go out to the factory the day she dies and say, your wife's been shot in the driveway.
Oh, my God.
And then, where were you at the time? And no, I'm here at the factory. And then later on, people said, well, I'd heard an argument in the backyard a week before. Mark was arguing with someone, and we can prove there was an argument. And then you've got to look at the fact, well, could have he set this up? And then he gets formally interviewed. And I said to him one other day, you know, it's hard enough. I've got to come out and I've got to tell you that your wife's dead. Then I'm accusing you of setting it up and that. But that's the process that you have to go. And when we did Elizabeth Memory, and I took that job over, Matthew Memory, the son, had never been formally interviewed. And I went and interviewed him, and Roger rang me up and he wasn't happy. He says, how dare you accuse my son Matthew of being involved? I said, Roger, do you want a thorough investigation or not? He said, yes, I do. Well, I said, Matthew's never been eliminated. Matthew has a car identical to the car that's in the driveway at 1 o'clock in the morning, right? For some reason, he doesn't get on all that well with Elizabeth. So he has to be interviewed. Once he's eliminated, we'll move on. So it's difficult at times because you've got to start fairly close to the family centre.
Speaking of the family centre, you talk a lot about the importance of your relationship, your marriage, in the success of your career. And you always nominate your wife as being your sort of strongest advocate, and your greatest achievement is your relationship. Did you talk about work at home?
Yes, I did. It might be 2 o'clock in the morning when the phone would ring and they say, oh, we've got a homicide at a particular location, someone's been shot. So I would have a quick shower, and then I've got to make a lot of phone calls to get services and that there.
Your daughter says that's her sort of main memory of you in her childhood, is hearing you on the phone in the middle of the night.
But then I'd say to Colin, I'll see you when I see you. And then I might be gone for 2 days, 3 days. And then when I'd come home, we would talk about it. She'd say, oh, what was the job about? And you'd say, well, this man was shot five times. We've charged somebody, or this is where I think the direction we should go. And I think being able to talk about it has probably helped me a lot.
Yeah, that's got to help your mental health to be able, because Colleen's a nurse, right?
Correct.
She has been a nurse all her life. So I guess she's got a strong stomach. It must have been helpful to your mental health to have someone you could come home and really tell what's going through your mind, what you've had to see today, and know that they're going to be okay with hearing it.
Oh, no, she's a mental health nurse, so she's always been strong. That's where she met me. But she's always been strong. But then on the other side of it, she might be planning to work tomorrow. She's got to take the kids to school, and all of a sudden is, I'm not there. And there are times where I've been gone for a week where all of a sudden there's everything around the house she has to do. But, yeah, she's been tremendous. 42 years being married to somebody who's been involved in law enforcement, she needs the medal.
Well, you were saying before that during the Jane Thurgood Dove investigation, you barely came home for 6 weeks.
So I was getting into the office during that investigation at 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm. The computers we had back then were 286, so they were very slow. So between, say, 4 o'clock and 7, I'd look at all the information that came in overnight and then get it set up so that when the other detectives come in, we would sort of have a discussion and then we'd go out and it would be 10 o'clock at night where we'd sort of finish for the day, just quickly go over what we've achieved and go home. So I didn't have a day off in 6 weeks. And then she said, hang on a minute, there's a family here. You know, you can't keep doing this. Mm-hmm. And it is about balance sometimes. You will fall over, but I think it goes back to this expectation that the community have that you're going to solve these crimes.
Yeah.
So you throw yourself into it just trying to achieve that result.
But did you ever think, like, you made the decision to make those sacrifices for the community? Colleen knew when she married you, this was what she was, you know, to a certain extent what she was getting into. But your daughter had no option but to sacrifice you for the sake of the community. I mean, I know it's going to sound stupid, but I feel that for my own children. I work a lot and I think, you know what, I've made this decision, but it's like I'm forcing them to make sacrifices for my career. Did you ever feel that? I know we can't compare what we're doing.
No, but Colleen would say now, I had a choice, but I made those decisions.
Yes.
To do certain things. And the classic is for 15 years I drove coaches interstate while I was a homicide investigator. So
that sounds like a bloke who doesn't want to come home to me. Now, I know that's not the case. I'm sure that's not the case. But if I were married to you, I would think this bloke does not want to come home.
Or Colleen would probably say that.
Yes.
And you know, when I sit back now, I probably can't justify doing it. Mm. She said, you made a conscious decision when you had a day off to drive interstate when you could have been at home.
Yeah. Why did you do that?
Yes, I could have been. But for me, it was like an escape, like let all that world of homicide be behind me. Mm. And it was like 48 hours of doing something different. The world lifted off your shoulder. And when I would get back into Melbourne, it was like back on again. And yes, it probably actually helped me keep myself sane.
Yeah, clear your mind. And I mean, what
but
were
Colleen
you thinking?
Would say, well, you could clear your mind at home
of course.
And you do the garden.
Of course. Or just sit here with us and watch telly and have dinner like a normal dad. Did they throw that at you a lot? Just like a normal husband. Can't we just go to the movies and just do normal stuff?
But I wasn't normal.
No, you're not. You are not in the nicest possible way. And now, in your retirement, I can't believe how far away you are going.
No, so we're heading to Trinity Beach, just near Palm Cove. I'm building a house up there.
Up near Cairns. Yeah. So from Melbourne, where you've spent your entire life and your career and you've built so much and there's a community that's lent on you so heavily, you are out of here.
I'm out of here. Tuesday week, the caravan's hooked on and away we go.
God, do you reckon you'll be okay? I mean, it's beautiful up there. I just came back from a holiday up there myself, but do you really reckon you can live up there?
Oh, we've been going up there for about 5 years. I have a son up there, and he's looking forward to us being up there, and the two daughters say, well, hurry up, get up there because we want to come for a holiday.
But are you going to get bored?
I'll take the advice of Jeff Kennett. Okay. Jeff Kennett rang me up and he said, Ron, don't do anything for 6 months. Have a rest, and at the end of 6 months, do something that's physical, do something that's mentally challenging, but never work full time again. So,
yeah,
I've had offers, you know, to do certain things, and at the moment, I'm going to have a break.
Yeah, and then any idea what you'll do after the 6 months? Anything you're looking forward to, or are you going to wait and see what feels good?
Oh, some people say, you know, would you come on a board?
Yes,
you know, as a an advisor on a board, I've had offers to write. For papers.
Yeah.
But I honestly think I want to get away from all that.
Yeah.
If you're going to ride around crime in Melbourne, then you need to be here. You need to have a finger on the pulse. I don't want to get up every morning and look at the bad stories that are in the paper. I've done it enough, so.
And would it be frustrating for you to do that and not be able to, you know, march in there and say, righto, I'm going to take this over?
I think it's about getting your head mentally around. So I always thought that I would finish my career at the homicide squad. I'd been there 25 years. And then I was asked, well, Ron, it's time for you to move. So I would have been happy staying there. And I said, all right, well, if I have to move, I move. And people said, well, Ron won't cope. But I got myself around that mentally that I was going to do something else and was the secretary of the police association. When I walked out the door, I said, I won't be back, and I haven't been back. I now know mentally that I'm right to actually retire, but I think I want to move away from the policing environment. You know, it's been 42 years, and then others say to me, Ron, you won't cope. It's like getting out of prison. You've been
institutionalised
for 42 years doing one particular thing, and then all of a sudden is you're going to go out and not have it.
Yeah.
So, look, there'll be some adjustment, but I think I'll cope.
You know how you see those blokes around town who've obviously been in jail a lot, and their jeans are really neat and ironed and pulled up, and their T-shirts tucked in, and their socks are pulled up, and their sneakers are white like you have to be in jail? Do you reckon, how are you going to go with the suits? Are you ready to let the suits go?
The suits are gone.
Are they really?
Be shorts, thongs.
Yeah, but here's the real test. Are you going to change your mobile phone number?
No. You might want to ring me.
I will definitely ring you, but forget me. I'm pretty low stakes in the phone calls. You get phone calls from perpetrators who want to give you tips, from people who want to confess to you after years or retract alibis that they've given for people. You have family members who ring you. I saw a website for a girl, Sarah McDermott, who disappeared many years ago, and on the front page of the website it says, if you have any information, call Ron Idles, and your mobile number's on there.
Yeah, so
how are you going to retire when everyone's still ringing you?
Well, I can be retired and pass the information on, but I do have one or two who stalk me.
Do you?
Who are not police groupies, but whenever there's a crime, I get one particular call, and it can be all hours of the day, all hours of the night, and I know the number, so sometimes I won't answer it. And then this person then will ring back half an hour later, no number, and I'm obliged to answer the phone because it might be a policeman or whatever it is, and it's this particular oh, Ron, what's going on? So.
And do they ever have real information to share with you?
Or no, he just wants to know what's happening. Who do you think's committed this crime? Why do you think it's happened?
Oh, God.
You know, I got text messages over the weekend. What's my view on Easy Street from someone else? So sometimes it is a bit frustrating, but I say if your phone's on, you might actually solve the crime. So Erwin Kastenberger was shot at the Blackburn North Shopping Centre in about 2005, and I was looking for a bloke involved in that, and he rang me 1 o'clock in the morning, and he said, "Ron, I want to give myself up," and I said, "No worries." So we yakked for half an hour, and then I said, righto, we made an arrangement. He would come in and see me at St Kilda Road at 4 o'clock. Then he rang back an hour later. He said, you're following me. I said, mate, I'm in bed. He said, well, can I go and visit my girlfriend? I said, you go and visit your girlfriend. I'm telling you, I'm in bed. The deal is if you come in at 4 o'clock, it is. And sure enough, at 4 o'clock he came in. Now, that took a lot of courage for him to ring my phone and to say I want to give myself up. Mm. If you miss that call then, he may not ever ring back again. So that's why I've done it.
Yeah, and all this stuff, of course it happens in the middle of the night. Of course homicides happen in the middle of the night. Of course guilt overcomes people in the middle of the night. That's why you're always on the phone at night time.
Correct.
When your daughter would wake up and hear you mumbling down the hallway, that's why.
It was pretty sad, I suppose, when your phone rings and it's late at night, you know someone's died.
Yeah.
Most times. I did have another criminal who... I got reasonably close to. He's currently in jail and he's been charged with several murders. But he would say to me, Ron, I only kill Monday to Friday. I never work past 6 o'clock.
This bloke understands work-life balance.
Yeah, he does. And I never killed on my birthday. But he did kill the day after his birthday once.
I bet.
So, you know, there are fascinating stories around.
And Christmas. I remember reading that you invested a homicide every Christmas for 11 years.
Christmas was a time of tension for families.
Mm. But do they kill each other? I mean, I knew everyone kind of dreaded it to some degree.
There were a whole range of things. once that was an argument over the credit card. The wife had spent too much on the credit card, so he killed her.
Oh, wow.
Another one was they didn't like the present and killed his wife. Another one was an argument at a property in Mildura where someone was shot. Another one was a very tragic event. The young boy had been given a crossbow for Christmas and the guy, his neighbour, was sitting in a plastic chair out in the backyard having a can of beer. The little boy was 16, looked through the wrong side and the arrow, travelling at 400 feet a second, went through the back fence and killed his neighbour. Now, when you walk into that house and there's 30 people there for Christmas dinner and it's just a tragic event. So Christmas was always a time where, yeah, as I said, 11 murders in 11 years. But people say, oh, well, families should get together, so they all get together, haven't seen each other for 3 or 4 years because of a whole range of disputes, have a few drinks and then the truth starts to come out and there's simple arguments and sometimes it's just a couple of punches, someone falls over, hits their head and they die.
It feels to me like in a lot of cases it's not hard to find yourself, well, certainly not hard to find yourself in prison, I always think, but also murders happen fairly easily, don't they, over small things. It's not often this big lead-up that we see in movies.
I think there's a misconception about murder. Some people think it's something that's planned over a long period of time. Well, it's not. You just got to prove that the accused person does an act and at the time he intends to kill or do real serious injury.
Yeah.
And people sometimes say, well, what's a murderer look like? Well, he looks like you or I.
Yeah.
But it's a case of their emotions have outrun their intelligence. So it's just at times it can be frustration. And there were 7 main motives for murder: revenge, lust, greed. And sometimes we look for the motive, but it's something simple.
Mm.
Like Dennis Allen, who lived in Richmond, was a criminal, but he killed people for playing the wrong type of music.
Mm.
So sometimes you look for something deep and sinister, and it's not that. And then there are other times it's just born out of frustration.
And if you try to deny it, it seems to me like, you know, I've accidentally killed someone and then I try and take you on. And you are a very smart guy who's seen everything before in your life and I'm desperately trying to look normal and backpedal and convince you that, no, I didn't do it. I can't think of a much worse period in my life than that, than sitting opposite you in an interview room and trying to get out of it.
Those who say that they didn't do it, you will always see that there's, like people say, well, let's look at their eyes and if they're looking up, it's very hard to tell a lie, right? So you might ask the question straight off, did you kill Bill Smith? No, I didn't. Do you want me to believe you? Right? And then the third question is why I should believe you.
Mm.
Now, did you kill Bill Smith? No. Do you want me to believe you? The truthful person will say, absolutely. Why should I believe you? I didn't do it. I is a strong commitment. Didn't is past tense, right? So if I ask you, did you do it? No. Do you want me to believe you? Well, I hope you would. Why should I believe you? Well, you know what? I'm not the sort of person who does that.
Yeah.
That is an indicator to me that you're more than likely that you're involved.
Mm.
In 85% of interviews around the world, sometimes they're never asked that direct question. That direct question will actually cause you a little bit of stress. But if you go on, then it's about, okay, tell me where you were between this period of time. It's about locking that account down. And then if you have other evidence in the end, you come back and you put it to them. So you told me you weren't at the 7-Eleven store, is that right?
Mm.
Yes. Well, I want to show you something.
Oh, God, it's scary just you telling me this now. Right. I can't imagine the fear of being in this situation.
But I've had people who've sat there for an hour and a half who have then given an account of their story and you make sure that there's nowhere for them to move, right? And then you just, you know what, Dylan? I've got to tell you something. I'm struggling with what you're telling me. You told me that you're at your friend's place. Well, you also told me you had your mobile phone. Can you explain why your mobile phone is at Oakland Junctions when you told me you're at Layla? Now you just sit back.
Oh.
Because silence creates an uncomfortable feeling. Now, I've had interviews here where I leave them for 10 minutes. Did you understand the question? Yes.
And they're just desperately trying to think of an answer.
Yeah. And wow. Then it's about empathy. You know what? I think I understand. I understand when you tell your story, we'll come understanding. Sometimes with that comes sympathy. But you have to be genuine in that. And I threw the tables, interview tables out because the greatest barrier to an interview is a table.
Mm.
An interview is just a conversation.
Yeah.
It's an engagement with someone. And there's two gifts that you've got to have that you give, the ability to listen and the ability to understand. People want to be heard. People want to be understood.
Yeah, I want you to understand how I got to this place where I killed somebody.
One guy says to me, you know what, Ron? This is after an hour and a half. You'll understand, but the community won't.
Yeah.
You know what? I think they will. When you tell us what happened, I think they will understand and there will be some sympathy towards you. And he went on and he told his story.
I bet you've had to sit and pretend to understand some real animals. Can you find this genuine compassion for everyone? Have you ever sat with someone and thought, nah?
No, I've always been genuine, because I think if you're not genuine, the suspects pick it up.
Yeah.
Whilst they might tell you an horrific story and you think, how could you do that? You know, one guy's cut someone up with a chainsaw and then burnt him, and you think, animals don't do that.
Yeah.
But then there's this big picture, like, you need to solve it. You need to get some answers for the family. And then you're trying to understand why in the world did that happen. Mm. But it is about genuine empathy and trying to understand. And if you cut the person off, then you won't be a successful interviewer.
Yeah, that goes for both of us. Do you have any regrets when you look back?
No, I don't have any regrets. Probably the only thing is, early days, it's about the balance with your family.
Yeah.
In the latter time, I would say to detectives, family is first and foremost. You need to go home. And then they'd say, but Ron, you're not going home. Well, no, I'll get home, but you need to go home.
Can you come up through the ranks in the police service, though, with that attitude? I mean, if you want to keep moving up, can you put family first?
I think now it's all changed, because they don't want you working more than like 12 hours.
Okay.
So there's occupational health and safety thing is fairly big now. Whereas, you know, in the early 80s, we would go 40, 50 hours straight. You just can't do that anymore. So it's about that balance. And I think we've learned a lot. Victoria Police is strong on strategies about looking after each other now, mental health. In the old days, I think people probably went to the pub and had a few beers. Now it's more like you'll go and have a latte and breakfast. So we've done a 360.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about alcoholism in the force?
I think years ago it was accepted that you drank, and whenever you did a big job, you drank. You went out after it, and then you didn't go home, and that were the issues. I think that some things happen around marriage breakups. It's a stressful job, and some people use alcohol to relieve that. I think probably over the last 5 to 10 years, we've started to learn more about other things that you can do. And as the police association, we brought out Dr. Gil Martin from America. We've brought him out 3 times now. He's around work-life balance. Don't let the job absorb you, because otherwise you will basically go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's about continuing to do some of those hobbies that you did outside and having that balance. And it's about physical fitness, because you're hypervigilant all the time. It will have a physiological change to your body.
Mm.
Policemen start to get overweight. They start to get diabetes, because you've got adrenaline pumping all day. And then at the end of that, it's like depression, because you've got no adrenaline.
Mm.
So we send you up and down on a roller coaster ride. So it's about understanding what effects it's going to have on your body and how you deal with it. So I think we've come a long way in the last 10 years.
It's amazing the dedication that you brought to that role in advocating for police, the same sort of dedication you brought to homicide. And I'm assuming the same sort of dedication you're going to bring to your shorts and thongs in Port Douglas. Where are you? Palm Cove.
Palm Cove.
Oh, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
I'm going to ring you in 6 months. Is that
okay?
I'll give you your 6 months to do nothing, and then I'm going to ring you and I'll bloody fly up with a microphone if you'll have me, and we'll talk some more, because I think not only is it just interesting, but I think it's important information for us to integrate into our lives. The knowledge and understanding of how these terrible crimes happen can only help us avoid them, surely.
Look, I think it is, and I've been public speaking probably for 20 years, and you know, one of the things I say is we're caught up in the fastest paced world we've ever seen.
Yeah.
We've actually lost the art of communication, and I think sometimes we need to just put the handbrake on a bit. We have 2,800 people a year commit suicide.
Mm.
Now, that's a tragedy. if a A330 plane went down with 400 people, you'd probably Boeing would ground them, right? We have 7 a year go down and we don't talk about it. So part of it is about communicating, and I've never seen someone commit suicide where there's not a warning sign. But because we're caught up in this fast-paced world, we miss the signs. So part of the public speaking is awareness around that, because not only a homicide detective, we look at things that could be natural causes, accidents, suicide and homicide. So my public speaking has been around awareness, and the message out of that is, yes, this is how we investigate crime, but it's about also looking after each other.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Look after yourself. Bron Idles, subject of Justine Ford's excellent book, The Good Cop. Okay, Emily, it's time for another book suggestion for those of us who love reading true crime books. This week, you're talking about The Society Murders, The True Story of the Wales King Murders by Hilary Bonney.
This covers the story of the case of Matthew Wales King. And at the time, this got unprecedented media attention. I was actually living overseas at the time in London, but I used to follow it in the media. So Matthew Wales King was the son of Margaret Wales King, and she was married to a man called Paul King, so that wasn't his father. But it also tells a story of the real blue ribbon kind of lifestyle in Melbourne that we're all a bit fascinated with. And it's actually, Hilary Bonney said that it received so much media attention because the Wales family is rich and the killing of one's mother is still taboo. So what happened was Matthew had his mum and his stepfather over for dinner one night. He and his wife Maritza entertained them, and basically it was their last supper. He drugged them and bludgeoned them to death, and their bodies weren't found for a while. But
the bodies went straight into the garage, didn't they, initially?
Yeah, for a while.
Wrapped in plastic.
That's right. And then they were buried out up in the Warburton, out that way. I know the papers covered this extensively because it was crime, money. You know, Matthew was propped up a lot by his mother. His defence, you know, claimed that he was, always chastised by his mum. He was a disappointment to her.
Homicide copper Charlie Bazina told me that on the day they went up and found the bodies, Matthew led the police up to where the bodies were. He said to Charlie, it was not about the money. He wanted to make it very clear that he hadn't murdered his mother for the money. Mm. And I thought that was really chilling and fascinating that he wanted to make the point that it was because he hated her.
Yeah, and that came through in the book a lot. Yeah. And the fact his stepfather died because of the fact he was there, but he was also an extension of, Margaret. And she was a very formidable figure. I mean, Matthew met his wife Maritza. She actually had nothing to do with the murders. I think she was quite shocked by it all, but she was charged with attempting to pervert the course of justice because obviously she, helped cover up the crime. But she came from, the outer east in Boronia, and she met Matthew when he had a hairdressing salon at Knox, Knox out in Wanturna. And there is quite a classic bit in the book where Margaret and Paul were going out to meet Maritza's family for the first time, and she was very concerned about driving the BMW out to Boronia and leaving it there because, they lived in Armidale and it's all very
leafy
privileged.
And she was worried about the safety of the car in Boronia.
Yeah, because it was, Boronia. But, and Matthew, I guess, lived in the shadow of, he had some learning challenges at school. He was always being given money by his mum. And I guess, as the defence claimed, he was possibly just getting revenge against her for how she controlled him, allegedly.
It is really one of the most fascinating murder stories I've ever heard about. And the aftermath too, he was one of those classic guys who gave interviews about, I don't know where my mother is. Crying at the funeral, all that stuff. That's The Society Murders, The True Story of the Wales King Murders by Hilary Bonney, available now. And if you like reading about true crime, you must read our very own Emily Webb's books, Suburban Nightmare, Murder in Suburbia, and Angels of Death. You can get your hands on those books by hitting the Shop Now button on our Facebook page.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian true crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review and 5 stars on iTunes. Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davron, Kieran Simpson and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together.